Dr. Lee, do you want to see this patient with me?
Yeah, let's go see him.
Could you explain to me what happened today? What were you doing? And then what happened to you?
I'm a softball player. I play ASA softball. When I come out the field, I was kind of white, but then I started having a tingling through my lower bottom lip. It was jumpy. The side of my face started feeling like I had, when you hyperventilate, you get that tingly feeling all over, but it went from a tingly feeling to it felt like my muscles were letting go on the side of my face, and it was kind of coming down. I felt almost winded, but at the same time, when I went to walk, move, I had kind of a heaviness in my leg, and it, like it was, had a bowling ball or something on it, and a heaviness, it didn't want to move with me for about 3 steps, and then I just came in and they said I was white as a ghost.
And this was all on your left side?
On the left side.
Did you get tingling in your left arm or left leg?
Not the left arm, but it felt like in the ball of the shoulder, it felt real heavy, like it was a real heavy weight on it.
Okay. So, but you had a tingling sensation on the left side of your face?
The cheek. Okay. From the jawbone up to the cheekbone.
And how old are you?
56.
Do you know of any medical problems that you have? I know you don't often go to the doctor.
No, none. No medical condition. I see OPD. I do smoke about a pack a day. I am athletically, physically all the time going most of the time, so I stay in pretty decent shape.
This is C3TIA, transient ischemic attack. And last month, we talked about strokes. So it seems natural that this month we would kind of continue that discussion and talk about transient ischemic attacks, right, Stuart?
Yeah, they're kind of usually mentioned in the same breath, right? The stroke slash TIA. And I think as we explore this, people will see why, because they're two sides of the same coin, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. So for this month, the things that we want to cover, first, we're going to clarify some terminology, which can be very confusing at times.
It can indeed.
Then we're going to go through the initial assessment, the history, exam, and very importantly, the TIA mimics, which can be very hard to sort out.
We kind of touched on that when we were talking about stroke, and now we're going to look at it from just a slightly different slant, but there's a lot of mimicry going on, that's for sure. That's one thing I know, a lot of mimicry.
And then the way that this makes sense to me to approach this topic is to sort of think about the workup of TIA in two broad categories. The first one is what needs to be done in the emergency department. So sort of the, like, what's the minimum that you have to do to start the TIA workup? And then the second category in my brain is what else needs to be done to complete the TIA workup? And that doesn't necessarily have to happen in the ER. It may not. But it helps me to think about it sort of in those two categories. What do I have to do right now? And what needs to ultimately happen, but not necessarily right now? And then finally, we'll go through the disposition. Who should be admitted, observed, who can get an outpatient workup, and the risk stratification of TIA.
So just before we get into the actual terminology classifications, I think you're going to kind of lay it down for us and give us some definitions. I just want to say that I think one of the reasons why ER providers find TIA a little bit frustrating is the same reason why we find syncope frustrating. Because something's happened to the patient, like, doc, I wish you could have seen type thing. You know, he wasn't moving his arm, I swear. But what's in front of you is someone who looks fine. And they're sort of describing, hopefully, accurately what happened. You know, a stroke, you know, it's easy. It's like they got a big deficit. We know they're going to, are we going to give TPA? What are we going to do? This is way different because it's all about, geez, he looks okay now. And I don't know if he's, you know, about to die. So that's really what the issue is here. So tell us about the terminology and then we'll sort through this.
Okay, so the traditional teaching for TIA, the way we used to think about it, is that the patient had some sort of neurologic deficit. And then within about 24 hours, it resolved. But there's a problem with this method of thinking. And that's because about 30 to 50% of the time, TIAs under this traditional definition, they actually, when you do the MRI, show an acute infarction on their imaging.
So what's really changed here, Jess, is our imaging. With the fusion-weighted MRI, we're able to pick up cellular death way, way, way earlier than you would on a CT that we've been using for years. And so what you really have here is a situation that was very analogous to when the sensitive troponins came out in emergency cardiac care. A lot of people that we just thought had unstable angina, their troponins were now positive, and so we had to sort of change the definitions. There was unstable angina where there was troponin leak, which was sort of a higher risk type of unstable angina. It was like an almost a non-STEMI, right? And then we had the ones that didn't have the troponin leak. But we still clinically used the same definition clinically for unstable angina.
So because of the ability to now detect these infarctions, even though they have no symptoms with diffusion-weighted MR, this has led to two definitions. So we all know TIA, but now we're calling that a transient neurologic deficit caused by ischemia with no acute infarction. And that's in contrast to transient symptoms with infarction, TSI. And that is basically like a TIA, but when you get the imaging, you see an acute infarction, even though their symptoms have resolved. So TIA, the symptoms are transient, gone, imaging, normal. TSI, it's like a TIA, except there's an infarction on the brain imaging.
And that actually tells you two things, Jess. For one, it's a stroke, that you know that that's what's happening. It's not a mimic if you actually see the finding on the MR. And it also means that that's a subset of patients. Even if they're not symptomatic at current, right, they have this thing on imaging, it means that they're higher risk for having a big stroke down the road.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I also want to clarify this definition of what is transient, because they don't give a time window anymore. We've sort of thrown out this idea of the 24-hour time window, and that's because there is no clear time window when brain infarction happens. That could happen for some patients within minutes, and for some patients, it might take hours.
That's a really, really good point. You know, we all taught in school that, hey, 4 to 5 minutes is how long a cell has to live in the brain. But there are subtleties here. Like, what if it's getting, you know, some blood flow, but not enough, and it's just ischemic? And as we know, ischemic tissues might actually take a little longer to die if they're getting partial flow.
And then one other thing I want to remind us of right in the introduction here is that TIA doesn't just apply to the brain, which is how we usually think of it, but it also applies to the spinal cord, also an important point of the central nervous system, and the retina as well.
Yeah. Remember, the eyes are the windows to the brain. In fact, they are the brain. And so when we look at the retina, we're actually kind of looking at brain tissue. That's kind of cool, right?
I thought they were the window to the soul.
Oh, you never thought of, what did I say? The window to the brain? Oh,
yes.
Oh, you're so ethereal. You know, Jess, if anyone is fretting about all these different definitions, TSI, TSA, at least some of those have to do with
TSA.
National security, don't they? Right?
Right, yeah.
Right. But if people are getting a little bit freaked out about the fact that the definitions are changing, you know what? This is something to reassure all of us. The bottom line is that whether or not you're dealing with a TIA or you're dealing with a small stroke, you know, it's a stroke with mostly resolving or almost all resolving symptoms and it shows as an infarction, it doesn't matter. Because from a clinical point of view, from a risk stratification treatment point of view, from our point of view in the emergency department, we're going to treat small strokes and TIAs in the same way.
And that's something that I feel like the junior learners sometimes miss. I certainly did when I was an intern, sort of this thought that, well, here's this patient in front of me who is normal. They're essentially normal. They have a normal exam. Why am I admitting them to the hospital? And that is because that a very significant portion of patients who have a TIA actually go on to have a stroke. Now, the percentages are estimated at different numbers here, but somewhere around maybe 15% of these patients with a TIA are going to have a stroke within 3 months. And about half of those patients who have a stroke in the first 3 months have it in the first 48 hours. So this is basically the minority report of neurology stroke care, right? Because you know that the attack is going to happen before it happens, and you can potentially intervene on a future event.
Minority Report.
Oh, the movie.
Yes.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand that. Well, listen, I was just going to say that the history of this is really, really interesting. At the turn of the century, and I'm talking about the year 2000, not 1900.
Okay, good.
Okay,
thank you.
Just we're in the new century now. Just in November of 2001, in fact, there was this big bombshell paper that came out of UCSF by Johnson. It basically was a wake-up call or a clarion call, as I call it.
A clarion call being?
Boop, 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 boop.
A call to action.
A call to action. Exactly.
Okay.
And it was a paper that showed it was all across the Kaiser hospital system, that when patients presented with the TIA, when that was their discharge diagnosis, the outcomes were not so great. By 3 days after discharge, over 5% were either dead or had a disabling stroke. And then there was over 10% at a month that had similar bad outcomes. And it was a big wake-up call, because up until then, TIA was considered sort of a go-home diagnosis, really without a huge amount of thought in dispo planning. And that really changed all of it. Now, after that, this is where the concept of, hey, listen, TIA is unstable angina of the brain. Something's about to happen. That whole attitude that we take for granted now really didn't exist before. And so things have moved quite a bit.
And you can hear more about that paper, which was covered on EMA in November of 2001.
Diagnosis.
So one thing we're going to go through in some greater detail is, how do you diagnose a TIA? Because a lot of what we think are TIAs turn out to be mimics. Actually, the estimates are kind of all over the board. Sometimes as many as 50% are mimics. There was one paper in 2017 that showed that about 18% of the time that we diagnose a TIA, it's actually something else going on. Most commonly, someone who's had a seizure or a complex migraine. And you can hear a discussion on that paper on EMA October 2011.
So, Jess, TIA. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to diagnose TIA.
Agree.
And there's a very good reason why the mimic rate is extremely high and the misdiagnoses are well documented. But there's three things that I would point out that are very helpful when you're trying to make a decision. Is this a TIA that this patient's describing to me? The first one is sudden onset. I really want to hear about a sudden onset, either spontaneously described by the patient, or, you know, sometimes what I do, Jess, is I say, do you remember what you were doing when this happened? And if they can remember a specific thing, oh yeah, I was combing my hair and then bang, you know, this happened. That's another way of saying, hey, it was pretty sudden. So that's the first thing. Second thing is negative. Not me being negative.
No, you're never negative.
No. Yeah, that's right. It's not a judgment call. It's negative in terms of deficit.
Uh-huh.
You want to make sure that the patient is suffering from a loss of something. They've lost their motor. They've lost their ability to feel, their sensation. It's the subtraction of a neurologic ability that characterizes stroke and TIA. And so we really want to hear, rather than, hey, I feel something funny here, or I feel an additional, you know, sensation of prickling or paresthesias. Those things are, to me, a lot less suggestive than I can't feel my arm or I can't move my arm. And so that's really, you're looking for the loss of something, whether it's a sensation, another sense like hearing, vision, a deficit.
Okay, so it's got to be sudden. It's got to be negative. And what's the third thing?
Focal. This has to follow this distribution of some vascular territory. This has to be an area of the brain. And we know what the different areas of the brain do, right? We know which area is in charge of motor. We know which area is in charge of speech. We know which one does balance and hearing, et cetera, et cetera. And so we want to be able to say, hey, listen, that makes sense. They have a loss of function that corresponds to an area of the brain that we know does that. So for example, Jess, a lot of people that come in with a rule out TIA presentation come in with a sudden global sense of weakness, a sudden global sense that they didn't feel right or they felt funny in the head. That's not really focal. I really want to have specificity for stroke. I really want something that I know corresponds to a particular region of the brain or spinal cord.
Great. So sudden, negative, and focal. Those are the three things to keep in mind when you're trying to diagnose a TIA. I love it.
So I think they said it really well, and I'm not sure I've got much to add, but if somebody comes in and they look like they've had a stroke, then that could be a mimic. So we're going to talk about workup. So it could have been a seizure, it could have been a brain tumor, it could have been something else. And there's also a lot of people who have a history where they couldn't move their right arm or they slurred their speech, but when they get to you, it's gone away. And we used to call that a TIA, but now we realize that there's a subset of those patients that have actually had a stroke, even though we can't see it clinically, we can see it on MRI. So the nomenclature here is all sort of changing, and our understanding is changing. And then you heard something that I think is really, really important. We used to believe that you look like you had a stroke, it went away, we do a CAT scan, we don't see anything, we call it a transient ischemic attack, and we used to send those people home. they're going to be fine. And now we know that a significant subset of those people actually will go on and complete a clinically relevant stroke within days to weeks. So you really shouldn't just sort of blow these people off. This is now a disorder, TIAs in particular, where you need to get neurology involved. They're probably going to ask you for extra imaging, and you might start them on antiplatelet agents and do much more than we did back in the day.
Chapter 2, Initial Assessment.
So now we're going to go through the rest of our discussion on TIA, and we're going to work through that case that we heard at the top of the episode.
What did you find on exam?
So on exam, he's oriented, he looks well.
What is his NIH stroke scale?
So his NIH stroke scale is 0.
And his symptoms are totally resolved now?
Pretty much, yeah. All resolved. He looks well.
So just to recap, we heard at the beginning of chapter 1, we heard the history from this patient. Just as a reminder, he was playing softball, and then he had this sudden sensation of a tingling on the left side of his face, and he described a heaviness on the left side of his body. And while that's not a total slam dunk for it being a TIA, it is something that patients will commonly describe as what they feel when they're having a little bit of motor weakness. They may just say it feels kind of heavy. And then tingling, you know, that could be paresthesia, but sometimes patients who have decreased sensation, when they touch their face, it feels to them like it's tingling, even though it's decreased sensation. So I think this is pretty suspicious for a TIA. And just as Dr. Lee said, his exam right now is totally normal.
Yeah, I actually agree. The fact that both of these symptoms are on the left side, I think definitely heightens your suspicion that this is a stroke TIA type syndrome. It's vascular territory, at least for sure. And definitely people are going to use different words to describe a motor weakness. And sometimes they get the motor and the sensory confused, actually, I find. They say that they have trouble feeling something when it actually is a motor weakness when you go to examine them. So for sure, I think that the suspicion has to be pretty high here. One of the things I would definitely want to know, though, going back to our original discussion, is the timing of this. Was it sudden in onset? Could we pinpoint the exact time in our mind? And do we have a time course for how long things lasted?
Yeah, and I can clarify that for you. In discussing it with him, he was able to figure out which inning of the softball game he started feeling the symptoms, and then it resolved about one inning later.
Oh, you've so got to say it was from the that, top from the top of the third to the bottom
right?
of the fourth. Is
yes,
that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So we said it was probably somewhere around 15 minutes that he right. had these symptoms.
Right. And that turns out to be pretty significant as we go through our discussion.
So what elements of the history are really important here? Well, it's what we've touched on. This is a clinical diagnosis. The patient's going to be normal as they're sitting there in front of you. So it's all about finding out exactly what were those deficits. How long did they last? And do they follow an anatomic pattern? And then as you examine the patient, of course, you want to make sure you're doing a very thorough neurologic exam, which goes above and beyond the NIH stroke scale. That will miss some subtleties if that were all that you did. And you want to make sure that if they had a prior stroke, which is something you're commonly going to see, that they don't have any worsening of their baseline deficit.
Yeah, you know, this one is really, really tricky, Jess. Because as the patients get older, a lot of them have had strokes before. Sometimes they've had multiple strokes, and it can be very difficult to sort out what is new and what is baseline, especially because when people get sick, for whatever reason, they get pneumonia, they get a UTI, urosepsis, they tend to have an exaggeration of the upper motor neuron deficits that they had before. And so sometimes in order for me to really be convinced that there's something new going on, I need more than just a, you know, this seems a little bit weaker in this left upper extremity than usual, but that is where the stroke was. It really helps when you have something new, like a new facial symptom, a new limb. That really does help convince you that there's something new going on. And there's no easy answer to this. Sometimes if the deficits are quite severe, you have to get help and you have to consider that it could just be a worsened stroke in that same area, but it can be really tricky.
Now, another thing that sometimes residents may miss is checking for upper motor neuron lesions, which I think is something we should talk about.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important because some of these patients that seemingly have completely normal power, normal sensation, normal reflexes, really a stone-cold normal neuro exam after their report of what sounds like a TIA, will have an upper motor neuron sign, like a plantar response. It's upgoing, a Babinski sign. And that can be golden. If I see that, and it's on, the, for example, in this patient that we're talking about, if everything seemed normal on exam, But I see that there's an upgoing plantar, for example, on that left side. Hey, that's a really strong sign. Hey, this is probably upper motor neuron stroke related.
TIA mimics.
Now we need to talk about TIA mimics, which we largely covered in the stroke episode last month. But Stuart, let's discuss some of the really important mimics that we need to know about.
Well, you know, the way I think about mimics in TIA, Jess, is exactly the way you do, which is that it's a total overlap with what we've talked about in stroke mimics. But there's a couple of differences. And one of the important differences is that, hey, remember earlier how we were talking about these patients are similar to syncope patients because they look fine in front of you, but something really scary happened to them?
Yep.
Well, you know what? Syncope is a major differential of TIA. And so although we don't tend to think of syncope as a differential of stroke, it's not really a stroke mimic, it totally is a TIA mimic. And so in addition to all the things that we had to think about with stroke, like was it a glucose problem? Was it a sodium problem? Was it an infection, vestibular syndrome, all those mimics that we talked about with stroke, we have to add a big one when it comes to TIA, which is, hey, was this not something neurological at all? Was this something cardiac? Was this an episode of VTAC? And so I put syncope right up there, high on my list when I'm looking at someone who's thought that they had a TIA. You know, obviously when someone comes to you and they can clearly report that they had a slurring of their speech and that they had weakness of their arm, and it's all consistent, and they remember the whole thing, I'm not really thinking syncope, all right? It's not in the differential diagnosis. Right. But there are a lot of people that say something really scary happened, and I felt I couldn't move. And, well, those are the people that, if you explore it a little further, hey, maybe there was a loss of consciousness. Maybe that's part of it. And that overlaps with seizure, of course, as well. And so it all comes down to the finesse of the history. Just be aware that syncope is something that has been missed when TIA is on the menu.
Two of the other ones that are right at the top of the list are a seizure with Todd's paralysis. We talked about before that's a really common mimic that fools us. And a complex migraine, which is so fascinating when you see someone, especially if it's their first presentation of having a neurologic deficit with their migraine. That's really hard to diagnose.
So for metabolic abnormalities, you could easily have low glucose being a mimic of a TIA, that happens. But the history is going to be helpful. Did they get some sugar and did it resolve, for example? But you have to consider the electrolyte abnormalities. Sodium, calcium are often implicated. These are less likely to present as TIA and more likely to present as stroke. But, you know, you got to keep an open mind.
Of course, any sort of brain lesion, whether it's some mass or infectious lesion or blood. And that's why we're getting that CAT scan right up front.
For sure. There's a whole bunch of other things that mimic stroke and also TIA, like MS, other demyelinating diseases, acute vestibular syndromes. It's a huge mimic for people that are getting vestibular symptoms as a dizziness presentation. Peripheral nerve lesions, like, for example, ulnar neuropathy that's intermittent, for example, might be something that presents as a TIA versus as a stroke mimic.
And then, of course, psychogenic, which, again, diagnosis of exclusion. Not something we're diagnosing in the emergency department, but just something to be aware of as another potential mimic.
Absolutely.
Now, when a TIA follows a clear vascular territory, that is a much easier diagnosis to make than often what we get in real life. So say the patient says, oh, I had sudden onset of a right-sided facial droop, and I couldn't think of words, and my right side of my body felt a little bit weak. And the whole thing lasted 15 minutes and then it was completely gone.
Yeah, so exactly. So that totally makes sense for a left-sided middle cerebral artery territory stroke because you've got right-sided weakness, right-sided facial droop and body weakness. And then that, which is, you know, in the left hemisphere, and the left hemisphere also does language. So that all makes sense. And that's the common constellation that we see together. But as you know, the kinds of stories that we get are often less razor sharp clear, and you're left wondering, hey, it's got some features that sound like it could be a vascular territory, but others don't really fit.
So Stuart, why don't we go through some examples, like real world examples of what patients really say, and then let's discuss whether or not we think that was a TIA or a mimic. Does that sound good?
Yeah, okay, let's do it.
Okay, so first case, this is like real cases that I've seen recently. Someone comes in, brings in their elderly father and says, my father nearly fell. He seemed weak and he was acting out of it last night. I don't know what it was, but I think it was maybe a TIA or a stroke.
Okay, so with that one, way too vague. I don't see anything, for example, that localizes to a certain focal area. He's feeling weak. That could be any number of medical things. I don't know if that's from his anemia or from a global metabolic problem or if it's a focal neurologic problem. I also don't get the sense of a sudden onset of something. I'm not convinced about that. I'd like to see a certain time where we have a deficit. And being out of it, well, you know, that certainly could be part of a stroke syndrome. But again, it's not enough. It's too vague. So it's going to take a lot of drilling down and getting some specific things before I'm really going to be going down that TIA pathway for this gentleman.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a patient who needs more of a general medical workup.
Okay, Jess, I have one for you. A recent patient I saw was a middle-aged woman who said that her right hand was numb off and on all day the prior day.
Okay, so the first sort of clue that that's probably not a TIA, although you would think is this sort of stuttering symptoms. They've had these on and off symptoms for a whole day. But the clue for me is that it's just the right hand. So I would definitely want to clarify whether or not it involved her arm as well. But if it just involves the hand, then I'm thinking it's probably more of a peripheral lesion or a carpal tunnel syndrome, for example, and less likely a TIA.
Okay, so you know, you do the full exam and you'd look for upper motor neuron findings. But if on your exam you found, hey, there's some specific deficits in the ulnar nerve distribution, or I can find some carpal tunnel signs and nothing else, you might be able to go just hit down that peripheral pathway.
Right. All right, Stuart, I got another one for you. So this is an elderly woman. She's in her 70s. And she says that yesterday in the evening, she suddenly felt dizzy. She vomited 3 times. She felt really weak. And now it's completely gone.
Well, this one actually really makes you take pause because she's admittedly a little bit older and you're getting a sudden onset history with the dizziness. Now, as you know, dizziness most often is not something life-threatening, but when someone with risk factors or that's older says that they have a sudden onset of dizziness, they get my attention. And so I'm going to be delving into that one a lot more deeply. I'm going to be checking very carefully if she's got any other cranial nerve, either findings or on history, suggestions of a cranial nerve problem. And a really thorough exam to see if there's any other long track findings involved, because we've had a low threshold to work up this woman.
Right. And I think the big concern here, just to bluntly say it, is did she have a TIA affecting her posterior circulation, a vertiginous TIA?
Exactly.
Now, Stuart, there are some types of TIAs that most people, myself included, wouldn't necessarily consider in the category of TIA. So let's talk about some of these more exotic, rare causes of TIA.
Well, I want to make sure that we don't get pigeonholed, that everything that is in the distribution of a vascular territory that looks like a neurologic event is from atherosclerosis or from an embolic process. There's a few other bad things that present just like a TIA where the treatments are actually quite different. The first one is endocarditis. If a patient has a TIA type presentation, but they also have a fever, or they have indwelling lines and they're set up for bacteremia, of course, they could be having bacterial plugs that are flipping off their endocarditis that are causing TIAs, and antibiotics are pretty critical to their treatment.
So they're having basically septic emboli going to their brain, which we wouldn't normally think of as a TIA, but essentially it is. It's just a weird type.
Exactly. Another phenomena that requires special mention is cervical artery dissection. Dissection of the arteries, either your carotids or your vertebrals, when that happens, and there are people that are susceptible to that, like for people with Marfan syndrome are susceptible, you can get that with some minor trauma, even with yoga has been described, or with the chiropractor's office manipulation. And those patients might present with neck pain and stroke-like symptoms as the dissection actually serves as a nidus for a clot to form there. So those patients might present with a TIA-like syndrome. But what they really need is vascular treatment to address that torn artery. And so that actually sometimes requires an anticoagulation, ironically, or a vascular surgery consult.
Okay, so their little dissection flap is throwing off little thromboemboli to the brain, causing TIAs.
Exactly.
Got it.
The third thing is temporal arteritis. Temporal arteritis is a vasculitis. It's a problem with inflammation in the blood vessels. But that inflammation happens in blood vessels that, when they're blocked, cause strokes. And so sometimes again, the etiology of the blocked vessel isn't an atherosclerotic or embolic phenomena from vascular disease. It could be from an inflammatory disease. In that case, the treatment might be corticosteroids. And so they can present just like a stroke. A temporal arteritis patient can present with amaurosis fugax, which is that curtain-like TIA that patients have a curtain-like deficit in their vision. And if you don't recognize that there's actually an inflammatory etiology for that, okay, that you will miss the fact that they need steroids as part of their treatment.
Okay, so an arteritis causing a temporary ischemic event, blocking off the blood flow to either the brain or specifically the retina, as you mentioned with amaurosis fugax.
Last month, we talked a lot about stroke mimics because when you have a stroke or you think a person's having a stroke, and particularly if you are going to give them something really nasty like thrombolytic therapy, you better be sure that it's a stroke because those drugs are associated with significant side effects. And if you're giving it to the wrong person, that's a big bad deal. It's not as important in TIAs, but you do want to make the correct diagnosis so that you can get these patients, you know, the right imaging and the right follow-up and the right therapy. As we've said, TIAs is no longer considered sort of a benign thing. Don't worry about it. It's considered a, hang on, if I intervene, maybe I can prevent this person going on to have something worse. So just sort of going over that list again, remember that seizures can look like TIAs, that metabolic problems, particularly low glucose, can produce focal abnormalities, brain tumors, obviously, demyelinating diseases, CNS infections, acute vestibular syndrome, peripheral nerve lesions, radiculopathies, and of course, even sort of the psychogenic thing. But let me just state for the record, in case it's not obvious, it can be really hard to work out what's going on. And even sort of trained neurologists with all their residents and their fellows and their registrars around the bed taking a history often have a hard time teasing out exactly what went on. Was this just sort of a weird little thing that grandma had? Or was it really a TIA? Or was it a seizure? Or was it something else? It can be very hard, and the only way you're going to get to the right answer is with a really good history and a good physical and talk to the people who may have seen the event. And even then, you may not be 100% sure. So don't feel bad about it, but at the same time, don't fall into the, oh, well, it's too hard, I'm not going to try. Get a really good history, really good physical, and think about what else this could be. And that will get you on the right track to finding the right diagnosis.
Chapter 3, what should be done in the ED?
What tests do we need to get right away?
So typically when I want to rule out anyone has stroke symptoms, I always get a CT head, I get an EKG and a chest x-ray and basic blood tests, including troponin and PTINR, CBC chemistry. But obviously the goal is to get him into the scanner as quickly as possible.
And what are you looking for on that EKG?
So any like AFib or a STEMI. That's what I typically look for. If this is like a new onset AFib and he has some embolic event, that might be the reason why he has stroke-like symptoms. Or a STEMI, he's not perfusing well and therefore stroked out as well.
Okay, so Dr. Lee went through the workup that she plans to do for this patient. Let's review what you need to do as part of the initial workup in the emergency department. And there's a lot of overlap here from what we covered in stroke, but there's a few subtle differences. So when it comes to labs, mostly the same. You're going to get a CBC, you're going to get a chemistry panel, and you're going to get COAX.
All these patients tend to go on a cardiac monitor, and that's important because they're in AFib, and you can see that right away. And as we know, that's an important mechanism that puts them at risk for a stroke, and it really gets your attention, and it should. And absolutely, just like Janelle said, the EKG is important here because not only might you be able to see the arrhythmias like the AFib better on the 12 lead, but there's this very important relationship between the heart and the brain. And it's totally conceivable that the person had a primary cardiac event like an MI, and she mentions that, followed by a stroke. And that's one of the actual mechanisms of stroke is that it starts with cardiac ischemia. So if you have a patient, for example, that's diabetic, they might have had a silent MI, it's totally reasonable and important to cover that base.
Now, Janelle did mention getting a troponin as part of her workup for TIA, which may not be as important for a TIA as it is for a stroke, right, Stuart?
Yeah, totally. And I would be not at all dogmatic about that. If you think that there was some element of chest pain or you're worried about cardiac ischemia, have at it, order a troponin. But by no means is this part of the routine workup for a TIA patient.
So Janelle, Dr. Lee, she mentions getting a head CT, which not only is our practice where I work, that's my personal practice. And I think most providers are getting a non-contrast head CT on every patient who they're working up for a TIA. Now, I know that depending on where you work, you may not have a CT scanner available to you, or maybe it's your practice if you can rapidly get a diffusion-weighted MRI, maybe you do that instead. But personally, when I work up a patient for a TIA, I'm getting a CT every time.
Yeah, there are a lot of advantages to doing a CT. I think that it has an important role in ruling out some of the more serious mimics. For example, if the patient's older and there's any hint of coagulopathy, subdural hematoma has been known to mimic TIA, for example. Don't want to miss that. And so as the patients get sicker and older, the CT starts showing up more and more things that might actually really help you in management. Also, sometimes you see a prior infarct on a CT. And so a patient will have a presentation that's very suggestive of a lacunar infarct. And then you look at the CT and you see old infarcts. You're like, hey, that really increases the odds that this present presentation is just another stroke because they've had them in the past.
Right. And when you think about why are we getting the head CT? Well, it's sort of the same reason as why we're getting it in a stroke. You want to make sure you don't see blood and that you don't see a mass or some other brain lesion that could be causing these symptoms. So it's not a ton of radiation. We can get it done quickly. I'm definitely an advocate for getting it up front.
Now, another thing that comes up sometimes, Jess, is people come in with a big deficit, okay? And then you don't know if it's new or not. For whatever reason, you don't have the history. Maybe the patient also has some dementia. And then you do the CT and you see a big old infarct. Well, those are usually old infarcts. And that might be that makes sense. That's the patient's pre-existing deficit. It corresponds with that old established stroke. It's the new strokes that you're looking for on the CT, obviously, and the bleeds, but also a huge amount of information from what was there before. So what was there before can be every bit as helpful as any new findings.
Now, in the next chapter, we're going to talk a little bit more about MRI, which is something you don't necessarily have to do in the ER, though many people are able to and do an MRI. But for now, I'm just leaving it as head CT since that's part of my initial workup for TIAs in the ED.
Treatment.
And then in terms of treatment, what do you need to do? Well, if you have that negative head CT, a patient with a TIA, I give them an aspirin. Is that your practice too? Basically,
absolutely.
Unless they're bleeding or allergic to aspirin?
Absolutely. And I think the point should be made that in the past, we thought of aspirin in an MI as an acute treatment that is really going to change the course. But in neuro cases and stroke cases, it's just sort of a secondary prophylaxis and we're doing it for the next, for down the road. We now know differently. We now know that aspirin has an important role acutely in stroke. And so if they're having a small stroke, if that's what's going on here, you're starting to treat them for that right away. And so I absolutely give aspirin. The only time I don't is if they have an allergy. And it might be appropriate in that circumstance to use clopidogrel.
One last thing I think we should talk about is blood pressure control in the emergency department. So let's discuss how high should you let that blood pressure go and what medications should you give to intervene?
You know, as long as there's no bleeding on the CT, our general approach to ischemic stroke, and this also applies to the TIA patients, is that we're not going to aggressively lower their blood pressure. So even though we're going to see big numbers here, we're going to see patients coming in with 180 over 110, 190 over 115. Those are not uncommon. We're not going to jump all over that with IV meds and lower it precipitously because that might actually lead to worse outcomes. The buzzword here is go low and go slow. So start them back on meds they used to be on for blood pressure if they were once taking oral meds and gently get it down over the next few days. Start a new agent if they're not on anything. And titrate it up slowly, again, over days. That's the current guideline on how to treat high blood pressure in the acute TIA setting.
So a TIA in someone who has a very elevated blood pressure may be confusing about where that overlaps with hypertensive encephalopathy or a hypertensive emergency causing encephalopathy. So let's talk about how that's actually different than TIA with elevated blood pressure.
The key here is that the patient with a TIA looks great. I mean, they've had some symptoms and now they're better and they happen to have high blood pressure and they commonly do, right? Because blood pressure is a big risk factor for stroke, right? And TIA. The patient with a hypertensive emergency because of blood pressure in the brain, the so-called hypertensive encephalopathy, is actually quite a rare condition. These are people that have bad headaches, They get vomiting. They generally are altered. They develop an altered mental status, but they don't have the focal vascular territory type findings that patients in strokes have, like right-sided weakness, left-sided weakness. It's more of a global presentation of increased intracranial pressure and vomiting, altered mental status, that type of thing. And so that is a type of patient that we need to emergently lower the blood pressure on, but that's a totally different fish than the TIA patient who looks great with high blood pressure. We're worried if we lower the blood pressure precipitously in those types of patients that we might really have a stroke on our hands because of decreased perfusion.
So let's summarize this section. They talked about two things. They talked about your initial workup, what tests to do, and then they talked about your initial therapy. And so in form of initial tests, I don't like to talk about shotgunning tests, but obviously you're going to get a glucose bedside and lab. You're going to get electrolytes. Everybody does. You're going to get a head CT non-contrast mostly to rule out the other possibilities. Is it a tumor? Is it a subdural? Is there infection in there or something like that? In and of itself, it's not particularly useful for diagnosing TIA or even stroke. What you're looking for is normal. That's what you expect, normal. If it's normal and there's nothing else going on, then we like to give an aspirin up there early, much more aggressively than we used to. And if there's a reason not to give aspirin, we'll give something like clopidogrel. And then don't be surprised if at your place, there might be some combination of antiplatelet agents. This has not yet worked itself out fully in the literature about who should get what to prevent strokes or to prevent more TIAs, but certainly aspirin or some other antiplatelet agent is almost certainly going to get used during that initial phase. Blood pressure is really interesting. Blood pressure is associated with strokes and TIAs, obviously, but in the acute setting, it's really not clear what you should do if that blood pressure is high. So I really like what they're saying here. Most patients who come in with TIA look great and are great, and if they've got a big blood pressure, that's something that should be fixed over time. You don't want to acutely drop that because you can make things worse. You've stepped them back on their meds. Or if they're not on meds, you start them on a low dose and you get them followed up. But this is often something you're going to have a discussion with neurology or your primary care follow-up person if that person is going home.
Chapter 4, what else should be done, and disposition.
What's his EKG show?
His EKG just shows normal sinus rhythm. I didn't see any concerning, no arrhythmias noted, and no concerning ST changes.
Okay. What about his head CT?
His head CT is completely negative. I didn't see any signs of bleeding. I didn't see any signs of large infarct. Looks normal.
So what do you want to do at this point?
I think he needs to come in for a TIA stroke workup and figure out if he has any other underlying risk factors that might have predisposed him to this TIA stroke.
Just as Dr. Lee mentions, we're going to admit this patient and order an MRI, specifically a diffusion-weighted MRI, and that's going to help us diagnose whether or not this truly was a TIA or whether it was transient symptoms with infarction. And the only way to know is to get brain imaging. So this was covered on EMA in August 2017 in an article called Have Clinicians Adopted the Use of Brain MRI for Patients with TIA and Minor Strokes? You can take a listen to that discussion for more details.
And remember, though, MR is not the be-all and end-all. Obviously, this is a lot more sensitive than a regular MRI when you use a diffusion-weighted MRI, and that's a lot more sensitive in turn than a CT scan. So if it really sounds like they've got a TIA by history, it probably is. And the MR will still not be positive in a lot of those patients. So when I'm thinking about what to do next when I have one of these patients sitting in front of me, Jess, is first I think about risk, and then I think about mechanism. And what I mean by that is first I attempt to risk stratify them. And we've got some tools to talk about that in terms of how to do that. And then I also think about, in some of the patients who don't turn out to have really high risk scores, I think about mechanism. And when I say mechanism, I mean, hey, is there something really reversible or obvious that could be causing a big stroke down the road that I can do something about, like the carotids or the heart? And we'll talk about that.
Great. So when it comes to risk stratification, I know there's a lot of different tools out there, but one of the really common ones is the ABCD2 score.
And that score, Jess, is like sort of a hybrid of scores that were developed on both sides of the pond. There were some that were done in England and some that were done in California, and they've sort of been put together. And the ABCD score basically is very good at identifying patients at really high risk that need to come in, but it's not as good on the low end, and it still does let a lot of people that end up having bad strokes through the cracks.
Admission.
So how do you decide who gets admitted? Well, fortunately, there's some guidelines on this. from the American Heart Association, and they basically lay out three criteria to help you decide who you should admit for their TIA. The first one is patients who have symptom onset of less than 72 hours, right? Because if they said that they had these symptoms, but it was 3 weeks ago, well, I don't really feel an urgency to admit them right away.
Yeah, you're not
and
as
get
worried.
This workup done.
Right.
Okay, so symptoms of less than 72 hours. And number two, they have an ABCD2 score of 3 or higher. So they are of moderate to high risk, and they are at risk for an early recurrence or stroke. And finally, the third criteria is you also cannot get a rapid evaluation as an outpatient. That is oftentimes the case where I work, and that's why this patient in particular is getting admitted. There's just no way that we could get brain imaging and carotid imaging and echocardiograms all done in a reasonable time frame, so we're going to bring them in. There's some other benefits to hospitalization as well. So as we mentioned in the introduction chapter, many patients go on to have a stroke, and many of those patients have their stroke within the first 48 hours after their TIA. So if they happen to be in the hospital when they have that stroke, they could potentially have an intervention more rapidly than if they were at home.
Yeah, I like that idea, Jess. You admit the patient, so just in case something really bad happens, you're right there.
Yes, it's like the Minority Report admission. Another benefit to admitting them is that they're going to be on the cardiac monitor. So let's say they were having paroxysmal episodes of atrial fibrillation and they threw a clot. Well, now potentially you might be able to catch one of those episodes without some long outpatient Holter study. As we mentioned, you can get that diagnostic testing done in a more expedited fashion, and the risk factor testing, and hopefully some steps towards risk factor modification. And here, of course, we're talking about things like chronic hypertension or hyperlipidemia, diabetes, all the things that the neurologist and cardiologist would start someone on medications for. That can be done in an expedited fashion as well. Okay, so that's generally how we think about risk, right? Someone who is in their 80s, who had this sudden onset of motor weakness and it lasted for 30 minutes, and you really think this is not only obviously a TIA, but someone who's at very high risk for having a stroke and soon. But a lot of times, very often, someone has a much lower risk, say an ABCD2 score of a 2, and we still want to make sure we think about mechanism. What could have caused their symptoms that we could potentially reverse?
That's exactly right. You know, just the big saves here are in the patients that look great and the history is actually pretty subtle, but they got a ticking time bomb that we have to uncover. And so that's why that mechanism discussion is so important. So for example, in that patient with the lower ABCD squared scale, I would want to check for carotid Bruy. I want to immediately know if that person is one of those few patients that might benefit from a carotid endarterectomy. If this did turn out to be a stroke and they have a greater than 70% occlusion of the carotid on the affected side, I know that that intervention of doing an endarterectomy is going to majorly decrease their risk of a major stroke down the road. So that's really important.
So just like you're alluding to, we need some form of imaging of the carotids as part of this workup. Whether it happens as an inpatient in an OBS unit or a close outpatient follow-up, you need to get some form of vascular imaging. You can get a carotid Doppler. You could get CT angiography of the head and neck. Or if they're going to MR anyway, you can get an MRA of their neck. So whichever one you choose, it's fine. You just need to make sure that that is part of their workup for their TIA.
Absolutely. Just make sure you're thinking about the carotids right from the beginning here. And that does start with physical exam. The other big intervention that's on our mind from the very beginning, Jess, is anticoagulation. And AFib is the big ticket item. If we are seeing AFib either in our 12 lead or our monitor by history, that's obviously going to be up front and center, because if they've had a very small stroke or a TIA, doesn't matter. If we've got AFib there, we're going to jump on that, and these patients are going to get anticoagulated. Don't forget, there's some other patients as well that might need anticoagulation. Some of them have ventricular thrombi. There's patients that have big MIs and that have clots in their ventricle. And so echocardiogram is an important investigation to think about up front at the beginning.
So the echocardiogram is a really helpful study. And one of the other pieces of information it gives us is who could possibly have a patent foramen ovale, a PFO.
Yes, the famed PFO. And you see them doing that there, right? Just with their, like they do those studies with the bubble studies where they put the bubbles and they see if the bubbles cross from one side of the heart to the other. Can you remind everyone of why that's so important?
Yeah, of course. So let's say someone has a DVT in their leg and they throw a little thromboembolus and it goes up their IVC and it goes into their right atrium and then to their right ventricle, out the pulmonary artery. And then where's it go? The lungs, of course. Often thought of as the filter for strokes from the brain, right?
Right, exactly.
A lot of these, you know, small pulmonary emboli we don't even know happen. But if you have a PFO and some of that blood, instead of going from the right atrium to the right ventricle, is just taking a shortcut and going over to the left side of the heart, it's going to go potentially
to the brain.
To the brain. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's how a PFO becomes potentially an important player here. If you throw that clot and it shortcuts its way up to the brain, causing a stroke or a TIA.
Exactly. So, you know, some percentage of strokes actually aren't from blood clots on the arterial side. They're from venous clots. And so if you've got a PFO and a DVT, you're a sitting duck for a stroke.
Now, let's say that you happen to be working in an emergency department or an observation unit where it is possible to do this entire workup and discharge the patient home yourself. So if you happen to be the provider who's discharging this patient home, one thing that you want to send them home with is aspirin. And usually a baby aspirin, that 81 milligrams of aspirin, is fine. Higher doses haven't panned out to be more beneficial, and they just sort of increase the risk of GI bleeding. So you want to send them home with a baby aspirin.
And I guess you would call that secondary prevention at that point in time. That's the 81 milligram. Acutely, I use higher doses when I'm treating a stroke. But the ongoing therapy, 81 milligrams, seems to be appropriate.
Agree.
I think also I want to mention about clopidogrel, just to finish off that discussion. We mentioned that if they're allergic to aspirin, that clopidogrel is often offered up as the next option. But there's also some other people that actually get clopidogrel added onto regular aspirin therapy, Jess. And so if they are presenting back to the ER with a worsening or what they call crescendo TIA syndrome, they're getting worse, more frequent. Those are often patients that the increased risk of bleeding that you get with clopidogrel is actually justified because their symptoms are getting so much worse and there's not much else that can be done. So that's another issue. And sometimes people that don't have the clear-cut carotid to fix or the AFib to anticoagulate, there's nothing else that you can do except for add additional antiplatelet agents like clopidogrel. We are very careful with it, mind you, in someone who's got a lot of bleeding risk, and you have to have a good discussion about the risk and benefits at that point.
Consultation.
So let's talk about consultations. If you are admitting the patient, putting them in an OBS unit, or even if you're getting that rapid follow-up for them, who do they need to see? Well, of course, I think the obvious one here is neurology. You would like them to see a neurologist to continue the workup and also help treat their modifiable risk factors. And of course, also potentially a cardiologist if you think there's any cardiovascular involvement playing into the reasons of why they developed this TIA.
You know, Jess, there's a lot of different ways this can be done and different hospitals have different systems. But the key thing here is that they get care by specialized stroke TIA personnel. That really makes a difference. And so when the care is focused towards that rapid triage and evaluation of their risk and attenuation of their risk factors, they do way better.
Chapter 5, Summary.
Okay, so in summary, we talked about what has to happen or what we recommend happens in the emergency department. And then we discussed the continued workup that these patients should get. That should include a diffusion-weighted MRI, some form of vascular imaging, so image the carotids, risk factor modification, find anything that you can potentially intervene on, and get them the rapid follow-up that they need with a specialized stroke provider, ideally. If you want to hear a lot more detail about the risk stratification and treatment of TIAs, there's a really great deep dive on this recently on EMA, October 2017, that Ken Milne did on Time to Talk a Little Nerdy TIAs. So you could take a listen to that and nerd out with Ken Milne.
And so, Jess, how did our patient do?
Yeah, sure thing. So in the ED, his whole workup was negative. He looked well, normal exam, normal labs, EKG was sinus, non-contrast head CT was negative. So then we admitted him to the hospital and he got his MRI and that was also negative. No infarction. So this is a TIA and not a TSI since there's no infarction on the brain imaging. We got imaging of his carotids, which were also negative. His echocardiogram, also negative. And the inpatient team got him started on some blood pressure medication for his chronic undiagnosed hypertension. About a day and a half later, he went home with the blood pressure medicine and also a baby aspirin every day.
Peer review.
Our peer reviewer this month is Dr. John Trock, once again, from Case Western Reserve University, who works at MetroHealth Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio. And he just wanted to point out a few notes. So when we went through the differential of the TIA and stroke mimics, there's a couple more that we want to throw into the mix. One of them is cervical myelopathy. That usually presents with neck pain, and there's some sort of compression on the spinal cord. So patients can have what seems to be a focal neurologic deficit, like numbness or paresthesia of the arms. They could also have an abnormal gait, weakness of their lower extremities, or sometimes they get that electric shock sensation going down the arm, just sort of like we see with sciatica going down the leg. Another item on the differential is PRESS syndrome, PRESS. That's posterior reversible leukoencephalopathy. And that is a patient who is hypertensive and they're going to tell you they have a headache, or maybe they're not going to tell you that because they're confused, altered, vomiting, or maybe even seizing. But not always. They might just have a very elevated blood pressure, a headache, and what seems to be a focal neurologic deficit. And that's usually going to be a visual loss or visual change. That's because it affects the posterior brain, the occipital lobe, so it's affecting the vision. And finally, Dr. Strock wanted to point out a particular study, the EXPRESS study published in Lancet. Why is it so important that we do a TIA workup in a rapid, expedited fashion? What's the benefit to that? Well, in this study, they showed lower morbidity and mortality in patients who got that workup done in an expedited fashion. You could listen to Rick and Jerry discuss this very paper. They have a bit of a different take on it. And that was in EMA, February 2008. It was abstract number 11. So thanks again to our peer reviewer, Dr. John Schrock.
Summary.
Probably don't need to do any initial summary of that last segment, but I want to. And it goes like this. After you've done your initial emergency department workup, almost always in the big centers now, you're going to get a diffusion-weighted MRI. You're going to look for whether this is truly a TIA or whether it's actually a little strokey stroke. Okay, so that happens all the time now in big centers. In small centers without MRI, it doesn't get done or gets delayed. A lot of these patients now get admitted. The big Kaiser studies had hoped to show that you could just send these patients home, but it turns out they're at risk for stroke soon. So a lot of the time now they get admitted for an expedited workup. They get carotids done and they get their heart echoed and they start on aspirin, and sometimes they start on more than aspirin, and they get their hypertension organized. And this is done again in big centers by stroke neurologists and stroke teams, and that's all good. But sometimes they can go home. If they're low risk, if one of their ABCD2 scores is really low, if you can get an expedited workup, then sometimes you can send these patients home. But that decision is almost always made in concert with the stroke specialists and the primary care people and you. But now you've got a much better idea about TIA, about what to expect from the workup, about how you can get things moving along and talk in sort of an articulate manner with those experts. Whereas in the past, it was like, TIA, I don't know, send it home. Now it's like, oh, this is actually a pretty interesting disease that maybe we can modify the outcome if we do everything right. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, her name was Jess Mason. His name was Stuart Swadron. And this is C3.
So clarion calls an expression.
Yeah. I think that's what we're dealing here. A clarion is.
I was pretty sure
a clarion is B flat. No, a clarion is like a shrill narrow tube trumpet.
Oh yes, and I thought that was a clarinet.
No, it's a clarion. It's like the clarion call is to alert people of a problem.